Today we speak with Coach Logan Dobbs. Coach Dobbs is in his fourth season with the University of Tennessee Chattanooga. During his first three seasons at UTC, the program has the most wins in their first three seasons than any other time in school history. Within the UTC program, Dobbs is responsible for scouting, recruiting, player development, scheduling, external relations, and overseeing the program's analytics strategy department, among other tasks. The Mocs saw several different players attend major national acclaim during the 2024-25 season. Guard Honor Huff ended the season as the NCAA three-point champion. His 131 made threes were the most of any NCAA player in the country at any level. Garrison Kiesler set the all-time NCAA single-season assist-to-turnover record at 5.7-1. During his first two seasons at UTC, Dobbs helped the Mocs reach the SoCon Tournament Championship game in 2023 and had set a number of national marks with their see, share, and shoot style of play, including number one in the nation in made three-point field goals per game, the NCAA record for most players to make a three-point field goal in the same game, and number 25 in the nation in assist percentage. Previously, Coach Dobbs held positions with VMI, Little Rock, the NBA's Golden State Warriors, and G League affiliate Santa Cruz Warriors, and Stanford University. Prior to entering the coaching profession, Dobbs played basketball professionally for two seasons, one in Costa Rica and the other in Moldova. Prior to playing overseas, Dobbs played for Covenant College. We welcome Coach Dobbs to the podcast.
So what's how'd you get involved, you know, playing down in Costa Rica? What was that? How'd you get your foot in the
door? So I played overseas for 2 years after college, and my first year was in Moldova in Eastern Europe.
And how was that?
It was very different. I used to sort of joke it was like going behind the Iron Curtain a little bit. It's right between Romania and Ukraine, and you know, Romania is in the EU and Ukraine obviously is not, or has, you know, sort of a lot more Eastern sympathies. And so that's sort of the dividing line between the East and the West, I felt like. And so and even the country itself is like 50-50 Romanian speaking and Russian speaking. And so there's a lot of sort of cultural tension there, but, the younger generation is probably more Western, more online, more bilingual, things like that. The older generation, very Russian, very old mentality, but it was pretty different for sure. I liked it in a lot of ways.
What was the training style like, and just the style of play? I'm assuming there's a real get into absolutely one another and play football type
thing. Yeah, your stereotypes are pretty accurate. I actually it made a really positive impact on me in a lot of ways. I still bring a lot of that with me into my mentality towards coaching, because just a really, really like ruthless, merciless attitude towards competing over there, which is how it should be. Yeah. But no friends on the court. Even in practice, I mean, our practices were super intense and competitive. I could tell a lot of stories, but
can you tell one? Maybe not all of them, but tell one. I got some stories too, because I had a Croatian head coach. So
everything was, there was almost like no culture of like rest or pacing anything. It was 6 days a week for like 7 or 8 months, and it was really hard and intense every day. Practices were intense, games were intense, and we had another player on our team that was at my position. I ended up sort of matching up with him in practice a lot, and I would always remember just sitting in the locker room a few minutes before practice, and we would sort of come in the gym and be chatting a little bit and talking and pleasantries and things. And then a few minutes before practice, it would like start to get quiet. It was almost like, all right, now we're not friends anymore. You know, for the next 2 hours, like, you're my enemy, and he wasn't going to give me an inch, and I wasn't going to give him an inch. Yeah. And we would just be lacing our shoes up, and it would be dead silent. And we'd go out there, and it was like, no one was friends, you know? And then after practice, you're friends again, and everything was fine. But that attitude doesn't really exist in the States as much,
right?
Particularly today. It was really eye-opening.
Yeah.
I was grateful for that year.
And how knowing how much that played in your development of not just playing but coaching, do you think that is what are the pros and cons, I guess I should say, of not having that same intensity as far as going at one another?
I mean,
or is it a different intensity? Like, what's your viewpoint on it?
It's just really hard to go that hard for that long. Just from that perspective. Yeah. I mean, I think like there's a constant, and it's I in many ways I think that, and we can segue into this, but today's college mm-hmm. game has become that way. It's mm-hmm. basically like 9 or 10 months straight.
Yeah,
with hardly any downtime, and you just accumulate a lot of little physical bumps and bruises, and you just sort mm-hmm. of have to play through it. And it's really tough. I mean, I remember it was like, I feel like every week I had something a little different, your shoulder, your knee, your ankle, your back, whatever it was.
Right.
It's just a lot of pounding. And today's college basketball has become like that for better mm-hmm. or for worse. You know, we start the second week of June, and last week we went until the first week of April. That's a really long season.
Yeah.
And it was the same way over there. But the positives of it is it's just, man, it really changes you. I mean, I think it's hard for any person to do something that intently and intensely for that long and to not take days off. And it challenges you because if you have a few good days in a row, you have a human nature to say, well, I can go through the motions today. I've already been killing it this week or whatever. But you can't. And when you have teammates that hold you accountable and they're never going to take a day off, and you better not take a day off either. It really changes you. I try to get that through to our players now today is you've never really earned anything. And that's really hard. But heavy lies the crown. You know, you can go play rec league or D3 and it can be different, but if you want to be here, this is what it is. And it's honestly kind of a privilege. The rest of your life, you won't be able to do that. You won't physically be able to do it. But now when you're young, you can do these hard things, but they are hard. And I admit that it's really hard to compete intensely every day for a 9-month season. And so I think we do a good job here as coaches, like pacing this thing. We've learned how to pace the year and give guys the proper downtime and things like that. But the players have to have that mentality, and it's hard to have.
Yeah. So like what data or feedback are you looking for as far as, you know, your high, moderate, mm-hmm. lower intensity days? Hey, we're going full contact. Hey, today we're probably not going to go as hard, or maybe it's just, you know, a small tidbit to kind of get that intensity, but maybe not the entire time. What are you looking at?
We've been fortunate. We've had a lot of continuity on our athletic training staff and sports performance staff with mm-hmm. our strength coach the whole time that we've been here. And we use the Connexon system, which is like the Catapult system for biometric data. So it captures, mileage and acceleration and player load and jumps and cuts and all those things. And so we now have pretty good historic data on player load, and we're able to sort of match that with what we've done in years past that's worked.
Okay.
Both player load within a given practice, but then within a week, and sort of how we time out our week with light days and heavy days and off days and things like that. So,
and do you take into account like the other stresses as far as, schoolwork, tests?
Yeah, absolutely. Particularly certain times during the semester when we know like finals week and things like that.
Got it. Okay. So kind of jumping more towards the coaching side of things, you're in you're in Moldova, you went in Costa Rica. I mean, how'd you get your foot in the door into coaching? Like what triggered that? Is that something you always wanted to do, or was there like a moment?
Much closer to the first one. I kind of have always wanted to coach since, well before college. I think I had my eyes on it. Mm-hmm. And my personal goal was just to play until I sort of felt like I had become the best that I could be.
Yep.
And I really felt like my second year when I was in Costa Rica, sort of when that happened, mm-hmm. Those doors opened a lot more easily after the year that we had in Moldova. We had a really good team and had a really good season and experience there. The Costa Rica deal was totally opposite of Moldova. Moldova is like living in, I don't know, Detroit or something. It's freezing, it snows all the time, dark.
And
Costa Rica, the total opposite.
Yeah.
Coming home from there, I realized I was 26 and I was just like, I felt really at peace with being done. And I didn't want some of those relationships that I had to begin to go cold in the coaching world. And so I just started pursuing a lot of different relationships that I had. And some doors opened up to go out to Palo Alto in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. And I spent 2 years out there one at Stanford and one in the Golden State Warriors organization. I was with the Santa Cruz Warriors, the G League team. But I never really had any crisis of purpose. I always that was sort of my North Star from, I don't know, age 16 or something. Of I always wanted to go into coaching. And so a little bit of a longer and maybe less direct road than some people, but the positives to it was I feel like I've had a lot of breadth of experiences. And I think that helps when you're coaching younger guys to be able to relate to them and talk to them about, you know, what's it like to go overseas and be alone in a different country where people speak a different language and life is hard, and how do you navigate that? And if you want to get into coaching, how do you navigate that, getting back into it and things like that? So I'm thankful for that.
So when you were going down the road of, you know, you had these relationships, you didn't want to go cold. So like, what did you do to be able to keep those relationships and create new relationships? Like what events did you go to? Like what was that journey? What was that?
Great question. I was really, really intent on that during my 2 years overseas. I didn't want to be too much out of sight, out of mind. And so a big thing was I used my summers when I was back stateside really intentionally. And so I would go work summer camps and things like that. In fact, that's part of how I ended up at Stanford was I had spent probably two or three summers in a row just working their summer camps. And those guys, I grew up in Durham, North Carolina. Those guys on that staff, a lot of them were from Durham because they'd come from Duke. And so I just sort of had several years of relationships with a lot of those guys, and it was pretty natural. But other places as well, you just sort of travel around a lot, work out. I was working out kind of all around the country with different people and trying to keep those relationships warm. And then even simple as just staying in touch with people when you're overseas, just not being too much of a stranger.
Yeah. And I mean, what years were you playing overseas?
So I played from 13 to 15.
13 to 15. Okay. Yeah. So you're younger than I am. I was going to say like, so you still at that stage, Instagram was there. Facebook was there, those type of things.
I was right on the edge of where the world started to get pretty flat. You know, you could thankfully like FaceTime and stuff, iMessage pretty easily, which 10 years before that, it was a lot different.
So within the relationship realm, like what are some of the things, like you talked about just the basic email, phone call, those type of things. Like, can you discuss how you form like maybe some of more the new relationships outside of camps and traveling around, or was that the only things that you were doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think like attracts like in life. So as you know, birds of a feather flock together. As you meet people that you vibe with and connect with and share values with, they have other friends and people that they know that you connect with easily. Yeah. And so a lot of it is just sort of having the similar to your approach, I'm sure, reaching out to people that you think are interesting, inspiring, and starting relationships. And you find that a lot of times that's reciprocated really warmly. And there's a real culture of that in Silicon Valley too. That was what really part of what attracted me to that area is just a high level of dynamism of really curious people, super interested in meeting you and connecting with you.
Yep.
And it just creates a ripple. So I never found it to be that difficult. One of the fun things I think about getting older in your coaching career is that all your little sort of peon GA manager buddies that you start out with when you're 18 or 20 or 22, they go on to become coaches and assistants at other places. And all of a sudden it's like all us idiots are coaching now. And then it kind of gets fun, you know? So part of it is you don't start out thinking, I'm going to be friends with this person because of who he is or whatever, you know, status or title or whatever, but then we all grow up together.
Yeah. Right. So, and then what were the roles then? And how did you kind of transition from Stanford to Golden State? What was the name of Santa Cruz, right?
Santa Cruz Warriors. Yeah.
And then I think after that, VMI, or did you have
I went in between to Little Rock for 2 years as director of ops. Some of it is just somewhat necessity. You take the jobs that are open. And part of it is I've always thought that ops is a really important thing for everyone to do for at least 1 year. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's a little bit of a cope, but no coach wants to be a Dobo. Everyone wants to skip to being a coach.
To the audience what Dobo means.
Yeah, director of basketball operations. It's the person that handles, really running the program off the court. And it's a lot of inglorious work. But it's a little bit of a necessary evil, I think. Everyone should do it for at least a year because you learn so much about how a program runs. And especially today and we can get into some of the changes in college basketball on the NIL side and stuff, but coaches these days are you know, man, they're just executives. You know, you're a CEO, and the tip of the iceberg is the on-court coaching and the late game coaching and the stuff that people see on TV. But there's 95% of it under the surface that's just a constant conveyor belt of decisions that you have to make 365 days a year about everything you can possibly imagine. Mm-hmm. And being able to make wise decisions and informed decisions makes the whole program thrive and flourish. Everything from hiring people, you know, to budget, to marketing, to all sorts of things that have nothing to do with basketball. Yeah. And as a Dobo, I think you see that side and you learn it, and it's really helpful to do. So I was really thankful for those 2 years.
And then that was in Arkansas. So you mm-hmm. director of basketball operations. So when you were at Stanford, when you got your foot in the door, so to speak, mm-hmm. what was the role there?
That was like a recruiting and operations intern. You know, Stanford doesn't have grad assistants, partially because of the rigor of the grad schools there. So they have these sort of paid intern spots. So it was just sort of an entry-level staff position. A lot of it was recruiting. And this was actually helpful later in life, but these academic schools have to cast such a wide net in recruiting because of the academic standards, particularly Stanford. I was blown away with some of the academic standards there. So you're recruiting, thousands of kids if you count all the freshman, sophomore, junior classes that you're looking at. Mm-hmm. Just evaluating kids academically, it's a lot of work to sort of whittle that down in your funnel to your final class that you're recruiting. So later in life, I ended up at a military school, VMI, which is mm-hmm. similar in some of those ways where you really have to cast a wide net in recruiting. So that was helpful.
So when talking to, it's interesting how some schools divide up, and I'd be interested to hear how your experiences have been as well. Some groups, you know, they have go by state, they go by region, they go, hey, everybody just finds mm-hmm. everybody. Like what have been the philosophies as far as recruiting and who's mm-hmm. in charge of what?
Yeah. Regional is sort of how we do it. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably the best way. Although, as we've talked about a lot, recruiting is so different now than it was even 5 years ago.
Yeah.
The reason being because of the transfer portal.
Right.
You're really recruiting the same kids. You might recruit the same kid like three different times. Actually, we have a player on our team that we recruited three separate times, and now he's on our team. So we finally got him. But that's not uncommon. And now with agents and stuff, there's so much crossover, you know, these agents that represent a bunch of different guys. And it just requires a lot of communication once you get to the portal. We try to break it out geographically, but there ends up being a ton of crossover.
Yeah, so I mean, that kind of segues into our NIL and transfer portal discussion, right? It's changed, the game has changed a lot in the past 3, 4, 5, heck, 10 years. There's so much change. Mm-hmm. How do you guys at UTC approach your recruiting, both in the portal or upcoming high school players, do you even look at mm-hmm. upcoming high school players? Do you look mm-hmm. at other divisions? Like what is the philosophy at UTC and how do you go about executing it?
Yeah, great question. Really good question. This is a philosophical question that we're all struggling with. Mm-hmm. Everyone has a little bit of a different approach. I think that we would like to do it as much in the traditional way as possible, meaning still recruit young players, high schoolers, and develop them and retain them. Mm-hmm. But the reality is there's just so much that's outside of your control. If you recruit a freshman who's really good, it's going to be hard to retain him. If you recruit a freshman who's not good enough, it's going to be hard to retain him. And that's what you're kind of seeing around the nation on average, is you're seeing the best players on every team not be retained and the worst players on every team not be retained. And the middle is kind of what you can maybe keep. Mm. But there's every job is a little different and every situation is a little different. Being old is really important. It's basically impossible to win with young players today. Mm-hmm. Now that we just lost the COVID class, the fifth year class that we had for those 4 years. So the sport will be a little younger this year, maybe than it was last year. Mm-hmm. But, age and experience are really important. And so the portal does become probably the most important part of your job. And it's really difficult because it's speed dating. And there's a lot of competing interests now, and you have a very short amount of time and limited information to try to get some really important decisions correct. And it's not easy.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is going to, I can see this being a rabbit hole going down because I have so when you're talking about competing interests, right? You've talked about agents a little bit. How do you go about finding accurate information mm-hmm. on the person? Because I mean, mm-hmm. you're talking about speed dating, right? So the initial, it's like a first date. You have that conversation and everyone's super excited and oh, this is great. And oh, you're great. You're great. Amazing. And agent like, yeah, he's also amazing. And then
for sure.
I mean, do you then make a call to the coach? Like, and then it's like, maybe there's some amazing things, but let's hold the horses. Like how, what does this look like?
Absolutely. Yeah. You're right over the target. There's no easy way to do it. Cause if there was, we'd all do it. The reality, like you said, is that a lot of the initial conversations go pretty well. Like any other human relationship, it starts, you know, pleasant, then you see the real person and then you can build it back up. But, the reality is you just have to be as thorough as you possibly can. And that's what we do. You have to be a little bit neurotic. You have to be a little bit paranoid. You have to read between the lines as much as you can, take in context clues. When people ask me, you know, what kind of information do you get on recruits or prospective players? The answer is all of it. We get everything we possibly can. And I don't think anyone in the NBA would tell you differently. You're looking at everything you possibly can when you're making these decisions because it's life or death for your program. And getting it right and getting it wrong is the difference between a great season and a bad season. So we make a million phone calls. We look at a ton of data. We watch a ton of film. It's everything. We're very data driven, but we really also care about those intangible things a lot because you're trying to bring a bunch of strangers in. A lot of them have previous loyalties. They have different agendas. Some of them are thinking about the next stop in my career. How do I get my stats up? I need to go play pro. I need to make money. I need to transfer to high major. Whatever it is, everyone has their own agenda, and you somehow got to get all these strangers to fit together. And you've really only got, like I said, 9 months to do it. It used to be maybe you had 3 or 4 years to do it. You're trying to create a, you know, sort of a brotherhood in a really short amount of time relative to what we used to have.
Yeah. So at what stage within kind of that recruitment process, especially I think talking more, well, maybe you can divide this into if you see like they're in need as far as high school recruits and portal recruits, I guess we could call them. Where you're like, okay, these initial things check out, like at what stage do you really start asking those? I mean, and do you even ask such questions like, hey, we noticed in this game, there's a lot of head hanging, like what was going on? Or we see the body language of this, or in this, hey, we saw a clip here, you're really yelling at your coach, like, or, you know, insert, you know, negative trait potentially here. At what stage do you have those conversations, if at all?
Yeah, I think your specificity increases proportional to how far along in the process you're getting. The reality is you can sort of cross a lot of names off pretty quickly. I mean, you can cross a lot of names off pretty quickly just based on their stats before you get to anything. So you're starting really broad. You're realizing a lot of kids, no chance you can get them, or definitely not good enough. And as you whittle down and whittle down and whittle down, you're getting to your short list. And then a lot of it is coming down to red flags. Obviously, if you encounter a red flag early on, you're crossing that kid off. Yeah. But usually, like you said, you're staying with kids that seem like they're checking out. And as you go, you just got to drill down and drill down and drill down. And you got to be willing to take on those uncomfortable conversations head on and just be direct. You don't have time to beat around the bush. And they want directive. You know, they want you to be direct too. The reality is they're trying to figure things out. And it's all, you know, it's like dating, like you said. So being direct is good. And then just a lot of follow-up questions, you know, ask why a lot. Follow up on follow-ups, get, you know, allow people to talk. And then just taking context clues. It's no different than hiring somebody.
Yep.
You know, they're saying something that's 90% good and 10% not. Well, that's the 10% that's what matters. And you got to really have an ear to that stuff and don't just hear what you want to hear.
And so what are some, I mean, I have my own thought process of what that 10% looks like, but what are some, maybe some random comments, some nonchalance of things that come out that make you go,
yeah, great question. Well, there's a lot of them.
I'm sorry.
There have to be. Yeah, this is a little bit of like a little bit of an internal maybe joke amongst our staff a little bit. You know, come on, coach, how are you getting hung up on this little thing? You know, ridiculous kind of thing. But it's it's a philosophy that may hurt you sometimes. Maybe sometimes you're overly critical and you miss a kid that would have been good. Yeah. But on the whole, it's going to be positive. Err on the side of being overly stringent instead of overly lax, particularly on these character issues. You just got to protect that culture as stringently as you can. So we're looking at all sorts of things, players who are delusional, players who are self-focused. A lot of, you know, you run into that a ton. You know, they're looking for a program that exists to meet their needs. They're not interested in the team necessarily, or less interested in the team than you'd want them to be. Parents are a big one. I tell kids that all the time. I mean, your parents can mess up your recruitment really fast, which is sad. Agents too. You know, sometimes the reality is particularly with NIL, or, you know, this whole rev sharing era that we're in, is, you know, agents and players are asking for way more money than we think they're worth. And I think that most players, just speaking generally, this exists at every level. You don't realize how many other players are as good as you. And you think, you know, the sun is shining out of you, and then there's a huge gap to the next guy. The reality is, man, there's five more just like you right up on that whiteboard. And I just think if we are looking for players that are appreciative of the opportunity, that have some, you know, feet on the ground and perspective, and are hungry and humble. So a lot of that's cliche, simple stuff. But this new era is making it harder to find guys like that.
Yeah. And I mean, I want to talk about coach. I want to talk about agents a little bit. Because that is rarely, I mean, that's never really existed in the past. College players having agents. So do you find that there are agents that, you know, they're actually telling the truth and they're being not just honest, but they're also being what's the word I'm looking for? Like they're being on point for like what they're asking. And then you have like habitual line steppers that are just, as soon as you see this is the agent, you're like, this isn't going to work out. that type of thing.
Yeah, it's definitely a spectrum, more probably towards the second half of what you said than the first part. There are some straight shooters. The reality is that an agent's job is to get his client the best deal possible.
Yes.
So I think that there's a real broad range of extremely professional people all the way down to somebody's uncle that has no idea what he's doing.
Yep.
Got it. And I think the hardest thing is just agents not necessarily understanding the big picture of what's best for their player, particularly at our level. And I don't want to speak for the high major levels, but at this level, the reality is the vast majority of kids are not making life-changing money. You're making a little bit of money that sounds like a lot of money to you. And certainly you can live comfortably for the years that you're here.
Yep.
But man, you can make a bad long-term decision over what ultimately amounts to a very small amount of money. Yep. And the agents are not always incentivized to see that big picture. They're incentivized to make their client as much money as possible in the short term. Okay. So yeah. And there's really no way. The other issue is there's just no way to verify a lot of this stuff. There's nothing public. And so it's all like a game of poker, you know, they say, so such and such school offered him X, and you go,
great.
Maybe he did, maybe he didn't, you know, how am I supposed to know, you know? So you're taking in as much, you know, context as you can, and you're keeping your ear to the ground, you're making phone calls, you're doing your best, but ultimately it's poker.
I mean, and feel free to not answer this question, but I mean, have you ever even changed a position as a result of what someone else is doing? I feel as though if there's a certain value on a player that you see, you're like, this is what we offer. Well, they're offering that. Well, great. Well, this is what we're offering. Like, has there ever been any type of change? Or have you been, has the group really been consistent with like, no, this, but this is how we are.
Well, there's always negotiating to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. I think you have an idea in your mind of what a player's value is. Mm-hmm. We're all trying to play money ball. You're trying to get as much value mm-hmm. as you can for what you're paying. And sometimes it's take it or leave it. We're not negotiating this,
yep.
But other times you're living in reality and you understand the deal and there's a little bit of back and forth. But again, I'm speaking for our level specifically. I'm not necessarily speaking for the high major levels. The reality is at this level, there's a lot of players that are relatively similar. Now I'm happy for every player that we have on our team. Everybody brings specific strengths. Exactly. We recruit every player for a reason.
Right.
Absolutely. But there's no LeBrons out here. You know, there's no players at this level that are just worlds above everyone else. So at some point you can kind of put your foot in the ground and say, this is what we have to offer.
And then going to the coaches conversations, do you every single time talk at, like, if you have a player you're interested in, talk to, you know, the coach they're coming from. And then are those usually amicable conversations, or do you find that coaches are, you know, not happy because they're leaving, like, or do they kind of just see it like, yeah, this is the game nowadays?
It's becoming a lot more where people accept the reality of the situation. Maybe a few years ago, you had a lot more bad blood than you do now. And sometimes you still have those coaches that may not speak fully honestly about a player because of their own personal feelings. I think generally now it is what it is and people understand that. And so to answer your question, we speak to as many people as we possibly can. We'll speak to the strength coach, the GA, the AU coach, the parents, the high school coach. We go back as far as we need to. Okay. So we definitely do. We definitely talk to the coaches. And again, you're taking everything in context.
Okay. And so talking, that's more the NIL portal stuff. When you're looking at, you know, upcoming, like, new recruits, right? Is this high school recruits, are you doing, you know, the major shoe circuit things? Are you looking at high school games, all the above? I mean, are you finding the clips that garner your eye on Instagram or Twitter? Like, what are the things that draw your eyes that make you go, and then, you know, kind of go down that path to research the player more?
Yeah, really good question. The answer is somewhat all of the above. We cast a very wide net domestically and internationally. The higher the level of Division I that you coach, the smaller your pool of talent is going to be. We're kind of in the middle where there's certainly going to be a lot of kids that maybe at the low majors you wouldn't cross off your list that you can cross off here, but it's not near what it is at, you know, in the SEC, where you're recruiting a small number of players because there's not many players that are good enough. So it is a lot of grassroots recruiting. One of the advantages of the last decade or so is how much film is available online, particularly like grassroots film and high school stuff now.
Yep.
So you can get a pretty clear picture of a geographical area before you've even gone to a tournament or step foot in a gym. You can watch a lot of film of kids. You can talk to high school coaches, scouts and scouting services. And I think that really helps you come in prepared much more than you used to be able to 10 or 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And there's probably some regional bias. I think, you know, certainly it's easier to get to see kids that are closer by than others, but we do recruit nationally and internationally a decent amount as well. So it's all of the above.
When you spoke about scouts and scouting services, like, do you have ones that come to mind? They're like, oh, these groups are really good. I would recommend players sign up for these scouting services.
What are your thoughts on that? I don't necessarily feel comfortable sharing specific names.
Or groups. Say people. Yeah, no, that's fine.
I think. Yeah, I mean, we use a variety of scouting services, some that are national and sort of maybe a little bit less accurate, others that are regional and tend to be really good. And you kind of figure out who knows ball and who's good. And again, some of that is a little regionally biased. There's a lot of talent within, you know, an 8-hour drive of here. And so we can recruit a lot of good players in our area. But we were, like I said, we recruit everybody. So, I don't know. I guess I would just say, like, the more, if you're a high school player, the more exposure you can get, the better. But also trust that it's a lot less about exposure than it used to be, in terms of it used to be there was a lot of hidden gems. The internet didn't exist, and so getting exposure was really important. The reality is now most coaches kind of know who you are. And if your name's out there and D1s aren't calling you, it's probably not for a lack of exposure. It could be. But the reality is, I think it's highly saturated and exposed now. We know most names, and it's just about sort of zeroing in on who's realistic for you to recruit.
Yeah. Regarding the exposure element, I mean, basically kids are marketing for themselves. So when you're, what should players have in mind when they're putting content out, whether that be YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, et cetera, what should be on there? Like, is this highlights? Is this, you know, this is my identity. This is as I am a player. Are you playing against great competition? Like what are the elements that should be included?
I like that question. Yeah. That's really important. First of all, I think can be a turnoff if you're like constantly self-aggrandizing and annoying. If you're sending 10 DMs to the same coach over and over, you're not helping your case. And same with a lot of social media content that's very self-centered. Definitely don't post things that have profanity in them or things like that. Your like professionalism and adult demeanor is being evaluated constantly with your online presence. A lot of times your online presence is the only real impression that people have of you. You know, remember, there's 1,000 more of you out there. And so we can only spend a certain amount of time getting to know you, and that first impression is going to be really important. So being professional and mature on all your social media is really important. And then I think in terms of the actual quality of your content, the reality is, you know, real coaches, they're going to look at your full game, your full ability, not 8 dunks, you know, layup line dunks that you posted or something. That may get a little bit of attention right away, but if there's no substance underneath that, it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, no one's giving you a Division I scholarship without a thorough evaluation of your complete game. Yeah. And so coaches, I would say they notice the little things for better or for worse. So if the little details of your game are negative, that's bad. But on the other hand, it can be good for you. If you're a lockdown defender that doesn't get scored on, if you're a great teammate, if you make the simple right decision consistently, that's going to get noticed. I mean, I don't want to name names, but we have a player on our team that I think was like that when he was younger and being recruited. Not necessarily a sexy player, but did a lot of little things really well, and it was very evident in watching him. And he's got a great role on our team now. And so I just think focus on that. Focus on the quality of your game and in the details. And a lot of those things, you don't have to ask what are those things, because your high school coach or AAU coach is probably already telling you them. It's effort. It's, you know, running the floor. It's communicating. It's defensive intent, taking pride in not getting scored on, throwing the ball to the open man, being unselfish, avoiding bad shots. These are all very basic things. They matter a lot more than your windmills in the warmups.
So basically, if I have and correct me as far as minutes and stuff, you know, a 2-minute clip, right, on Instagram or Twitter or whatever it may be, it's like, okay, here are some of the things that I do. Here's my identity. I'm a shooter. I'm a slasher. I'm a defender. These are the things I do. But then showing those intangibles of like you helped out on, and then you sprinted out on an X out rotation. You were able to hedge and recover and get back and then make a second rotation afterwards. You dove on the floor. You took a charge. Mm-hmm. Like those type of things are going to be like, oh, so he's got a little bit of talent, and oh, he does these other things. And look, he's giving high fives to his teammates. Okay. Like, so those are all super important things if I'm hearing that correctly.
Yeah, absolutely. Those things certainly wouldn't hurt. You know, again, any coach that's recruiting you seriously is looking a lot deeper than your highlight reel. So you're going to have to have substance at some point.
Yes. You're going to have game film available. It's like, hey, we're interested, or even have full game. I mean, yeah, whether you get huddle like most places now, but you're
going to be able to. I think a big thing is like have good full game film that's ready to send and easy to send. Yep. You know, if I have to send 6 emails to your coach to try to find a link to download a game,
correct,
that's going to be harder for me. Be ready with a full game film where you played well that you can send, and not just played well in terms of scoring points, but, you know, avoiding mistakes, not taking bad shots, not having dumb turnovers, showing that you know how to play.
Yep. So. Absolutely. And going off of your talk, this is something I've talked with, you know, other trainers, other coaches as well. I've never been one to, and I want to hear perspective. I've never been one to be like, oh, hey, take a look at XYZ player that's doing ABCD at such and such a club, blah, blah, blah. For a lot of personal reasons, but do you ever feel as though those are potential positive things? Like if you have people, you know, trainers, coaches posting about other people, like, is that a positive thing? That's just kind of an own internal question, because I haven't been comfortable doing that about myself or others. But
you're saying posting or hyping up players that are not your own players?
No, that are your players. Like, let's say I train John Smith, right?
Yes. And, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Look at John's. Here's John Smith, you know, mm-hmm. training, and now here's some game film or whatever like that. It's never been my style, but mm-hmm. I wanted to hear your perspective on that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, getting good references from people that are close to you is really important, and I think it certainly doesn't hurt.
Okay.
What you do find, the reality is that we all have a lot of like availability bias, and there's it's the same for us when an NBA scout would ask us mm-hmm. about players on our team. Mm-hmm. Is you're looking through it through the lens of the Southern Conference, saying, oh, this player's really good or whatever. You're not necessarily qualified as the NBA scout to say how that player is going to translate to the next level. And so that scout should take what you think with a grain of salt. I would say that the trainers and coaches that really know basketball are the ones that are more likely to be honest about the deficiencies of their players, and then also like sort of hyping or talking about other players that are in their area or in their league. So the conversation might be like, yeah, I have this player, he's a really good shooter, coach, I'm worried about his defense, I'm not sure he can guard at your level. There is a kid at such and such school or in the town mm-hmm. over, man, he can really play, I think you should take a look at him too, maybe you look at both of them or whatever it is.
Yeah,
I think that you find those people that really kind of know basketball, and then you as a coach, you lean on their mm-hmm. their recommendation a lot more.
Yeah, and then there's that balance of, you know, it'd be awkward, I think, to post that publicly. Like, yeah, like here's sure. John Smith.
For sure.
But it is a potential, like, hey, like you're saying, maybe it's a personal email, maybe it's a phone call, maybe it's something yeah. that's more where there's more of a connection anyway, where you can yeah. have that talk. Yeah.
For trainers and coaches, I would just say be honest. Like, if you're having to try to like hype up a player more than maybe you believe in your heart, then it's probably not worth it. But if you have a player that's like, hey, that's the toughest kid I've ever coached in 20 years, and you post and saying that, that's great. That's helpful.
Right.
So it's true.
So let's segue into, you know, we've talked a lot about recruiting, but as far as at UTC, how you develop, right? Mm-hmm. So whether it's what's the methodology, the philosophy, are there any differences between those high school players that come in and the, you know, transfers that may come in, you know, mm-hmm. how do you go about player development and putting it all out there? Like, this is where you are. This is where we want you to be able to be.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, working, this is what we need you to master. This is what we need you to learn how to incorporate.
Yeah.
Et cetera. Yeah.
Great, great question. We, you know, you're always going to develop in accordance with what your style of play is and what you want yep. your team to look like.
Right.
And we've really doubled down on skill the yep. last 5 years in particular, but even prior, meaning the ability to pass, dribble, and shoot. And so we have a sort of an offensive mantra. We call it see, share, and shoot. We want guys mm-hmm. that can see the floor, that understand how to play, that see the big picture, that are unselfish and can pass, and then can shoot. And yep. that's been really backed up in our numbers the last few years. We've been one of the top 3-point shooting teams and assist teams in the nation. A lot of different mm-hmm. sort of stats that support that. But so as we develop players, we are developing them towards that end. And so one thing that we are really big on here is just the fundamentals and the simple stuff. You know, a cliche answer a little bit, yes, maybe, but we're not necessarily as reliant as some teams on individual ISO scoring and things like that as other teams yeah. may be. We are going to succeed by doing it together. And so guys that can, you know, basically we have every player on our team needs to be able to pass, dribble, and shoot. And yeah. so we're developing every player to be able to do a lot of those simple things, come off a ball screen in both directions with both hands, make the right read, play off 2 feet, throw the ball on time, on target to the open man, mm-hmm. Make simple decisions, play within yourself. And then shooting is a huge thing. We talk about shooting all the time. We shoot all the time. We do so much shooting. We view shooting as a measure of toughness. We We never, as Coach says, we never throw the ball at the rim. And we just do a lot of it. So, if you came to some of our individual workouts, you probably would not come away saying, well, that was really complicated. You'd probably say, well, that was a lot of basic stuff. But the aggregate effect of that on our team is, you know, if you're improving the fundamentals on, you know, 15 guys, the sum effect is large. And then the other reality, just being blunt, is that at this level, that's what a lot of players still need. We're not always some players that we have here, we can go pretty advanced with, but a lot of them, they still need a lot of the basic stuff.
So when you're, this is another potential rabbit hole could be, when you're looking at quote unquote fundamentals, right? There's been this huge, wave of incorporation of, you know, ecological dynamics, CLA, and, you know, basically read and react, being able to be put in situations, figure them out, and then shooting, right. You know, differential learning and such. How do you balance, if at all, if there is any differences between like doing stuff on air, doing things guided, doing things completely reactive and competitive? How does that flow within the landscape for you guys within the player development, whether it be individual workouts or in teams?
Yeah, really good question. We are very high on live reads, very high on it. Coach Earl, he'll say all the time, you get better by playing, you get better by playing, you get better by playing. So we're pretty low. Not that we don't do one on zero stuff or individual workouts. Of course we do. Yeah. But if you come to our practices and workouts, you'll see a lot of play. 3-on-3, 4-on-4, 5-on-5, 2-on-2, you know, 3-on-2, 4-on-3, things like that. So we're constantly trying to simulate real reads. Now, some players, of course, you have to simplify things because they're not ready for A, B, C, D, E. Yep. It might just need to be A, B. And so sometimes we're engineering those situations to make it simple. Advantage drills and things like that. We do like one simple thing we do every single day, which sounds really basic, is we just do 6-on-5 passing. And basically you have
six. I love that. I'm going to let you explain this, but that's the one I stole. I wrote that down afterwards for sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, man, it is like the simplest thing ever, but it is, man, it's bang for your buck, like one of the best drills you can do. It's actually five. We do it multiple different ways. One of the most popular ways is 5-on-6. And so you're allowing the defense enough players to trap the ball and be matched up with everyone else. You can give the offense one dribble or two. You can restrict it to half court. But, man, it's just instant reads. You know, who's open, see things before they happen. You better be ready to whip the ball to the open man. If not, dribble or pivot out and not turn the ball over. And you learn fast who has feel and who doesn't. And it's really, really eye-opening. That's just one small example. But to put a bow on that, you know, the answer is a lot of live reads, as much as we possibly can.
Got it. I'm going to dive down the 6-on-5 hole a little bit. When you guys are doing that, like, is that for time? Is that like 30 seconds, 20 seconds that like, and you're just not turning the ball over for that amount of time?
Yeah, right. It's 30 seconds or 20 completed passes, whichever comes first. And then you flip. Mm-hmm. And each team gets two chances, so you could get 40 completed passes as a max. Usually we'll do like redemption at the end, where if one team's down by 23 or whatever, we'll let them have enough time to get to tie it or whatever. Okay. And like I said, you can restrict it in all different ways. If it's too hard, you can allow the offense to have more dribbles. If it's too easy, you take dribbles away. Yeah. Things like that.
Yeah. Great. And that's also similar to, I don't know if you know, I think we talked a little bit about, I played for Tobin one year, Tobin Anderson, and I believe he has a similar like man maker drill where they have to go, I think they just do 5-on-5, they go full court, but there can't be any deflections, turnovers, and they can't dribble. And score full court on that as well. Like that's also a fun little, like take care of the basketball, learn how to pass, learn how to screen.
Absolutely. Passing, it's amazing how hard it is to find truly good passing. And I used to, maybe when I was younger, think, oh, that's a little bit of coach speak, you know, good passing, blah, blah, blah. It really is a skill to be a good passer, to set your passes up, to use ball fakes and head fakes and things to set up a pass, see things before they happen. And then just the physical ability to deliver the ball. And when you can get a group of guys that, you know, three or four or five of your guys on the floor can all pass, man, the whole is much greater than the sum of the parts for sure.
Yeah. But getting back to the player development, like do players like get booklets? Like, is this like, how do you track and monitor the player development throughout the year and say like, hey, you look, you are getting better. Hey, we're not meeting our goals, or how do you set goals, et cetera?
Yeah, really good question. And that's harder than ever because of you have a lot of one-year lifespans for players that maybe they're coming in with only 1 year to play, or they stay a year or whatever. So it's harder to have some of that longitudinal data. We keep a lot of data. We keep a ton of weight room data, obviously, NBA combine type data. But then we keep a lot of shooting data too.
Okay.
So a lot of that stuff we'll measure that's actually quantifiable. Some of it's less quantifiable, like how well can you dribble with your left hand or things like that.
Right.
So some of it is just the eye test, and we'll have regular player meetings and we'll say, hey, you know, here's where you're at. Here's where I think you need to get better. And then some of it's pretty tangible. Like, hey, we got whatever X number of thousands of shots that we've recorded from this summer, and you're eighth or whatever it is, you know, and you can really, track people's individual progress. So, I would say we stat as much as we possibly can. We have a ton, particularly when we get into like 5-on-5 stuff, we have a huge amount of internal data. We might have as much internal data as almost anyone in the country, certainly the top, 20 probably in the country. So we keep a lot of things, and we have a pretty accurate picture of our players. You don't always share the whole picture with the players. You're trying to figure out what's the information that's going to be useful for them to know. But we internally have pretty clear pictures of where our guys are at.
And then is this, so we kind of talked about the skill. We talked about the weight room data that you guys collect. What are you looking at as far as some of those other intangible things, as far as like the mind, leadership? Mm-hmm. What are you looking at there as far as like what you're observing, the feedback you're giving, and how you want those things to develop?
Yeah. Again, it's become a lot harder than it used to be because it's just the 1 year deal. Coach Earl was a point guard. I think that he really sees the, he was a leader and a tremendous player, but really just that ownership of the team. He was a 4 year, he was actually a 6 year player, but being, having that continuity year to year is rarer now.
Yep.
And so you're oftentimes bringing in players that you're trying to mesh your returners and some of your new players and figure out who your leaders are going to be. We sort of view leadership as plural. We ask a lot of different players to step up and take ownership. There is a nature nurture part of it. Some are more gifted than others. And a lot of it is just one-on-one meetings. We spend a lot of individual time with players, both as assistants and the head coach, challenging players individually. A lot of times we'll call people out in front of the team. We'll say things publicly. Some of it's private, some of it's public.
Yep.
But I think it's a little more led by feel now than it used to be, because maybe in years past it was a lot more obvious who your leaders were going to be, and players would fall in line. Now sometimes you get a tension between guys that are social leaders but not necessarily on-court leaders, and it can be tricky. But I've seen this really the last couple of years in particular. Teams will change even throughout the year a lot, especially these days. And so a little bit is you're flying by feel a little bit more as a coach.
You mentioned player meetings often, and you have them often. How often are you meeting with players, and what are the reasons? What are the what's the scope of the discussions? Is this always with the head coach, assistant coach? Like talk to that a little bit.
Yeah, we split up the players amongst the assistants. We all have academic pairs, and then we also have sort of basketball pairs, and then we will rotate the groups every week. So I think every 4 weeks I will have individual meetings with every player, and so will all the other assistants. And then Coach Earl will schedule periodic player meetings. A lot of times those correspond with like beginning of the summer or end of the summer or beginning of the fall or right before the season or mid-season, things like that. So, and then of course you just have like the unplanned organic ones of pre-practice or post-practice where, hey, I see you've been struggling a little bit with some, come over here, let's sit down in the corner and just talk and hear about life or whatever. So a lot of times it starts out with, hey, there's a few basketball X's and O's we got to talk about, but then it's also, I'm going to ask you about how your girlfriend's doing and how your family's doing and how your roommates are and all that
being
stuff.
Being a human being and caring.
very much. And it is tricky because a lot of times you got to remember, like, these kids are coming from other schools. They've got friends in other states. They've got other loyalties and allegiances. And now they're trying to make a new family here. And we're all trying to do that. We're trying to make a new home. And so you just want to help them as much as you can.
Got it. In regards to, I'm trying to think. I wrote some notes here talking about the player meetings a little bit more. So the head coach will meet with them, what, 2-3 times a year at least, formally.
Usually more than that, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And then, but they'll meet kind of basically, they will meet with somebody every week. It might be a different coach, but they're gonna meet everybody. You get some FaceTime with them every week.
Yep. And then a ton of impromptu meetings. Hey, I noticed so-and-so was struggling with something. Do I need to grab him? Yeah, coach, why don't you grab him after practice? That'll happen all the time.
And then developing that on-court and off, or I should say more off-court chemistry, togetherness. What are some of the things you guys do to build that culture, that togetherness, that chemistry at UTC?
Yeah, another great question. It's so hard, you know. I always say if you could have a 4-year friendship and form it in 1 year, people would have already done that. You know, there's some extent to which you can't accelerate these things. The best that you can do, I think, in forming chemistry and cohesion is just hanging out together as much as you can. So just get as many of those iterations in as you can. So we plan a lot of different team events. We do a lot of different things. In the summer, it's probably a little more casual and just fun, whether it's like go to Topgolf or a movie or dinner, team meals and escape room, like whatever, things like that. And try to make it a little less like pointed. Just let unstructured relationships build. As we get into the fall, we do a lot more community events. We go to volunteer events. We go to community dinners, media appearances, things like that, that have a little more of a specific goal. Mm-hmm. And then once you get into the season, there's just, honestly, you're just kind of with each other every single day and it sort of happens. So cross-pollinating as much as possible, just like, getting guys that aren't roommates to we're helping out with Ronald McDonald fun run this Saturday. Okay, so we're going to take these four guys and put them in this time block, and they'll work together at that event and spend time together, things like that. So just mixing it up as much as possible. But a lot of them live together. You know, they have apartments that are like literally next door to each other. So mm-hmm. a lot of that stuff happens organically. But you're trying to, like I said, you're trying to fit 2-3-4 years into one. It's hard.
How long have you been at UTC?
Since when? This is going into year 4. So I've been here 3 years.
Got you.
But this will be going into year 7 with Coach Earl, because I was with him for 3 years at BMI.
That's right. That's right. And so how has, since you've been with Coach Earl for the past 7 years, what has that been the evolution of the playing style from how he had played at VMI to where he's at UTC? What have the changes been?
Yeah. I don't want to speak for him too much, but I think that he would say that his first couple of years at VMI, he was sort of trying to recruit the best player possible, trying to be good on offense and defense, and that didn't really work. You're not able at VMI to always get the best players, and so you're trying to play the same game as everyone else, you're probably going to lose. And so the only way to do it is play a different game. And he learned, I think I'm speaking for him, but I think he would say this, like he learned within a couple of years at VMI that he was going to have to be different. And so we, right around when I first got there, we really began to triple down on shooting. Mm-hmm. We felt like shooting threes and creating variance, you know, variance is always going to pull you towards the mean. So the best teams don't want variance. The bad teams do. How do you create variance? You take a lot of threes is one way. And so we kind of became the best shooting team in the country. And some of that was personnel and some of that was style. We recruited to it really intently. We recruited a ton of really good shooters. One of the kids that played for us broke JJ Redick's all-time 3-point record, is like the fifth, made the fifth most threes in NCAA history. We had centers that could really shoot. So we were able to put 5 shooters on the floor, which is kind of rare. And then we played defensively, like some matchup zone. We tried to be different. We kind of felt like we couldn't guard man-to-man straight up. And so we were going to have to do things differently. So we were pretty complex. We were complex on both sides of the ball, which was really hard. At the time, thankfully, we had a lot of continuity. It was a little bit before some of this stuff got started. We were able to keep guys. And you get really, obviously, smart and mature and intelligent guys at VMI for the most part. So we were able to coach them up a lot and be complex. And so that's sort of where the C-Share Shoot identity was born. And we've, you know, we've ridden that wave to, you know, we're still on that train fully. Now we're able to get a little better athlete maybe than we used to be able to get. One of our big goals is to continue improving on defense. The back half of last year, we probably had our best 3-month stretch we've ever had on defense. Mm-hmm. And some of that was what enabled us to have such a good year. Hopefully this year we can continue to take a step forward on defense and kind of hit that next level while keeping our offensive identity the same.
Right. So how do you go about developing in your, what's the team's personal philosophy to develop great shooting?
Well, it's nature and nurture. You got to recruit good shooters. So we're pretty picky on shooting ability. In fact, it's funny. Sometimes you see new players come into our program that are consider themselves really good shooters, and they are really good shooters, and they'll be like the middle of our roster in shooting ability. Yeah. In fact, this year's team, and knock on wood, I think has a chance to be the best shooting team we've ever had.
Yep.
So you're looking for guys in the recruiting process that can really drill shots. You're looking at mechanics. You're looking at stats. You're looking at the way they get their shots off, trying to project how it translates, and just prioritizing that. You got to give up things. If you could get everything, you'd be the best team in the country. So when you're taking great shooting, you're sometimes giving up other things. Then once we get them into our system, we shoot with them a ton. We do tweak mechanics a little bit, but not a ton. We're not big on that. We sort of believe it's more about reps unless there's anything major. And again, usually we're not recruiting players that have major mechanical issues.
Yep.
So a little bit of mechanics coaching, but a lot of it is mentality, understanding where your shots are going to come from, shooting game type shots, and just shooting a ton of them, shooting a ton when you're by yourself, shooting a ton when you're in with coaches and individual workouts, shooting with the GAs on your own during the day, shooting in practice. And then just having a mentality of, coach always talks about like, just, you never throw the ball at the rim. You're shooting with the intent to make every single shot, and just adopting that shooter's mentality.
Yep.
We give guys green light. And part of it is you gotta be willing to sometimes let guys take bad shots a little bit. Mm-hmm. You're always trying to coach shot selection a little bit, but you gotta err on the side of leniency because you want guys to be aggressive.
Right. So when if you're assessing a prospect that's coming in, a recruit, and you run them through a shooting workout, what are some of the things you'd be doing? And like, what are kind of the low, medium, high grade of like, oh yeah, no, that was really good, or oh, we got it. I don't know.
Yeah. We have a really simple, sort of one-time test that we can give. It's sort of like our SAT of shooting, and it's, we call it 2.5 minute shooting. So you just have one rebounder with one ball and one shooter. The shooter starts with the ball. You're behind the arc, and you can't shoot the same shot twice in a row. So you got to move around the arc, a couple steps between every shot, and you shoot for 2.5 minutes. And you should be able to get off about 40 shots, give or take, in that 2.5 minutes. And sort of a good standard goal would be 25 makes, 25 out of 40. But, good shooters will hit 30 or above. Great shooters will hit 35 or above. Our all-time record is 40 out of 42, I believe.
Okay.
And if you're under 20, you're not, we would not consider that a good shooter.
Yeah. So 25 is kind of the entry level. Then you have that 30-ish range, and 35 is like, okay, like absolutely. Yeah.
Real, and the real thing that kind of gets you is the college line is deeper. And so if you really want to test yourself as a high school player, shoot from the college line and see what you can do. Even getting off 40 attempts is not always easy for a high school player, because if you,
if
you're swishing it,
down quick.
You're not chasing the rebound. If you're bricking it, you're chasing the rebounds. So
right, absolutely. No, that's a great little thing that I'll probably steal from you a little bit and see how some of my players do with that. Cool. I think that is the vast amount of stuff that I wanted to talk about. Trying to think if there's any other rabbit holes I want to go down through. Nothing that's really coming to mind. So I think we've
anything that from your perspective you wish college coaches would do better or differently in the recruiting process for high school kids?
Great question. And I can only speak from the outside looking in, hearing the information that I know, because I'm not obviously a college coach, right? So I can only speak from that perspective. It sounds like there is a great amount of background research being done, which is great. Okay, so something that sticks out to me that may or may not be related to your question is, I think that seeing things as players, and I didn't realize this until I played professionally as well, like how good players are. Like, yeah, and this goes back to your talk about how you don't understand, you're 1 in 1,000 or you're 1 of 10 or you're 1 of 20. There's a lot of other players. I think there's some there are a good amount of high school players that may, especially if they're not on the EYBL, and even if they are in the EYBL and some of the top circuit teams, really seeing mm-hmm. what it looks like to mm-hmm. play and train at that level. Mm-hmm. I know I've been trying to do a better job to create relationships, to bring players mm-hmm. to come in to watch. Mm-hmm. I think being proactive and to be able to, hey, let's connect with, even if they're, I don't have a recruit with that team, hey, bring your team in and come watch us train. I think that can be so inspirational for the players mm-hmm. and the coaches. Because until you see it, like, I think a lot of people just think it's coach talk. Mm-hmm. Like, oh yeah, you got to talk in every possession. Like, it has to be a loud gym. A loud gym is a winning gym. Like, high fives, mm-hmm. like winning teams talk and touch. And you say it ad nauseum. But until you go into the environment and see that, like, I think that can be something that's super inspirational. Again, not exactly answering your question, yeah, but being able to create more of those like relationships within the local communities. I think that can be extremely beneficial.
Yeah.
Even if you're not going to be recruiting some of those players, but just from like a personal human basketball player development to understand the stuff that your coach is talking about, like,
yeah,
this exists, like this is the level.
Yeah.
That's kind of my initial piece, and I'm going to be experimenting with. I got a hopefully a small group that's going to be going up to one of the universities here.
That's great.
There's always these NCAA rules of like, who can you bring? Who can't you bring? What's the time period you could bring them? So it's, there's that type of stuff.
Yeah.
But I love
it when high school coaches reach out to try to bring players by or teams by. I think it's really beneficial. I've said to our staff before, I wish that we could take our entire team to a G League practice.
Yes.
The G League is like a graveyard of 5-stars. I mean, yes, it's amazing how many incredible players are in the G League, like superstars in high school.
Yeah.
And they're playing in front of 400 people making $75,000 a year, and they'll never make the NBA.
Yes.
A really good player. I mean, back-to-back conference players of the year, whatever. Right. The best players that would ever be in our league that are doing, I don't want to say doing nothing, but they're in this sort of graveyard of, yeah, no, again, no offense to some of the unbelievable players in the G League, but it's, right, it just, my point is, it just goes to show you how hard it is to be, yes, great. And some kid that thinks, oh, I'll be here 1 year, then I'm gonna go to the NBA. It's a lot harder than that.
Yeah.
You
know?
There's a lot of you out there trying to do the same thing, and they're all pretty darn good too.
Yeah. No, I was extremely blessed. A couple of years ago, I went and when Pannone was at Alabama, I was able to go watch like some of their practices, and his friend that used to coach with them, TJ Saint, is with Birmingham mm-hmm. Squadron. He's like, hey, you want to go watch that practice? I was like, oh, absolutely. And then to even go from the Alabama practice to that, I was like, holy cow.
They're so good. I mean,
people have no idea. And until you get in and you see that, oh, like 7 foot, you know, that 7 foot one guy that's passing it like a point guard, no look, alley-oop stuff. You're like, all right, what?
Yeah.
but yeah, I think, so kind of going back to your question, especially as there's this transitory time of, you know, we're having these one and dones and people are transferring. I think as coaches, we crave relationships and to being able to build and develop. And I think that's kind of an untapped market to be able to create the local community connections mm-hmm. and really develop the local coaches as well. And just have players witness what that is like. I think that's my biggest piece of feedback as far as like actual recruitment process stuff. I'd have to probably think on that a little bit more, but before I get out there, I'm sure I'll come up with more.
Yeah.
because it sounds like you guys are so thorough, and it is an interesting balance between making sure it is a personal relationship and it doesn't become transactional, but it's mm-hmm. so hard when you have these like 1 year mm-hmm. Type of situations. But it's, yeah. Biggest thing I think in anything in life is like be open and be honest, right? Yeah. Like you don't want to oversell. And I don't think you guys are doing that. And I hope that's not happening within the landscape. Being open and honest about like what the potential role is, where you see you could possibly be. But,
yeah.
Yeah. Let me think.
That's a huge pitfall for college coaches. You know, Coach Earl talks a lot about, you know, undersell and overdeliver, undersell and overdeliver.
Yes.
The reality is a lot of coaches, they benefit in the short term from doing the opposite, oversell and underdeliver.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of tell kids what they want to hear out there, which it works in the short term and doesn't work in the long term. But it's hard. You know, it's important to try to be as honest as you possibly can, for sure.
Yeah. I think we'll have more I've heard that phrase before, undersell, overdeliver. And I think that is a potential seed for future conversations. When I'm out there for sure. Cause I think there's more aspects I want to be able to talk on in that, but I want to be also very respectful of your time. So,
well, we look forward to having you down here. That'd be great.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to it. And I'm looking forward to watching some more practices and hopefully some games too, getting out there and supporting you guys. Like, guys, I really appreciated that. And I'll be there taking notes as like last time. And I appreciate you being on here. And I'm looking forward to talking with you some more.
Awesome. Thank you, Eric.
All right. Thanks,
Yep. Take care.